Hey friends, Landon here. Welcome to the Waterville Community Church Sunday Podcast.
Well, before I get going this morning, I just wanted to say and remind everybody, I gave a sermon last week that probably was shocking to some people, and we're going to do a sermon kind of Q&A discussion tomorrow night on our Facebook Live at 8:30 p.m., so for those of you that want to join us for that, be on our Facebook page tomorrow night at 8:30. We'd love to have you join us for that. We have been in a teaching series that we've called We Believe. We've been looking at the content of the Apostles' Creed, if you've been here, if you've been following along. You may have judged by the video. I want to step back from that series for a week and have a different kind of discussion. We'll pick it back up next week, but the lives that we're living and the season that we're in, things are changing so rapidly that I feel like it's helpful more frequently to just step back and just take a pulse of kind of where we are as a faith community, where we are maybe individually in our own faith lives. And so we're going to do that this morning. We spent about 4 months with our doors closed to in-person services, like a lot of churches, obviously. And some things changed. We made the decision on July the 5th to reopen our doors to in-person services. So it's been about a month that we've been in sort of in this new phase. The week before we reopened the doors, I did a message similar to this one, what we're going to talk about this morning. And I used the language of, in the biblical imagery of exile, to try to frame and talk about this experience that we're all having in this COVID season. If you weren't here that morning, or if you're not familiar with the story of exile, to give you a very quick recap synopsis, a long time ago, God chooses a man named Abraham and promises Abraham that he's going to give him many descendants, as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the shore. But it's a means to an end. God's very clear right from the beginning. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to give you all of these descendants, but it's a means to an end. It's ultimately so that your descendants can bless the whole world. And my intention is to bless all people. I'm just going to do it through you. And so Abraham has a kid, his kid has a kid, his kid has lots of kids. And before you know it, what started with one guy turns into a family of about 70 people. They travel from what we now call the land of Israel south to Egypt to avoid a famine. And they end up staying there longer than expected. As they continue to grow, the ruler of Egypt, the Pharaoh, he gets a little nervous that, you know, at any point, if they decide to mobilize against us, there's so many of them that we could be in trouble. So he takes preemptive, you know, does a preemptive strike and forces them into slavery, where they spend 4 centuries as slaves in Egypt. Eventually, God comes to rescue them through a man named Moses, relocates them from Egypt to what in the Hebrew scriptures in our Old Testament is often called the Promised Land or the Land of Promise, but not before, on the way, organizing them, right, constituting them as a kind of proto-nation. Right? The arrangement was pretty simple. God's in charge. Love God and do what God says, which at the time was like the Ten Commandments and some other things. And, you know, things will go well with you. Don't love God, don't do what God says, and they won't. And if you're familiar with the story, you know that over time, the people choose the latter, and things do not go well for them. At one point in their history, after many attempts on God's part to try to redirect them and kind of bring them back into faithfulness, they're attacked by a military superpower called Babylon. The people who survive the attack are deported. They spend 70 years as exiles, as political prisoners in a foreign country. 70 years go by, a few regime changes, and they're invited to return. They're given the opportunity to go back home. Some of them go, many do not. They don't go back at first, and some of them don't go back at all, which you can appreciate. Over the course of 70 years, you develop a whole life. You put down roots. Many people were born into exile. The only life they knew was life in Babylon. So there was this season where they were away from home, and then they were permitted to return home. Some of them did, many did not, either at first or at all. Those who did return were then faced, you know, the challenge of rebuilding, trying to reconstruct life. And that's where I want to pick the story up this morning as we stay kind of in the imagery, right? If we think of this COVID season that we're in as a type of exile, and if you didn't listen to my message on June 28th, I was very careful to explain all of the ways in which the two are not anywhere near like each other. Okay, so this is a very rough, crude analogy. But if you think of this COVID season as a type of exile, and by that all I mean is we were removed from our home, so to speak. That things have happened in our environment, in our context, that we did not control, we would not have asked for, we did not prefer, and it changed the way that we did life. And for a four-month period, we weren't allowed to be in person. And then some things changed, and we were invited to come back if we wanted to. Some did, some did not, and that was expected, right? When I gave this message on June 28th, I told you that this was the way that it was going to be. So whether you're here in person or whether you're attending online, the season we're now in and the challenge we face is rebuilding life together. So the question looming over us as a church is the question that looms over every organization, every institution. It's what is life going to look like now as we move into the future? What is church going to look like? Not only has the season that we've been in, has it created disruptions, but nobody has any idea what kind of disruptions it's going to continue to create or what sort of new rhythms and patterns are going to look like as we continue to move forward. What we know, or what I know, what I'm suggesting to all of you, is that we're in this season where we have to think about rebuilding life together. And there's a couple different ways to think about rebuilding. One way to think about rebuilding is you just put back up whatever came down. So it's just you lost something, and now you've got to change. You're just going to go back to whatever that was. You're going to put back up whatever it was that came down. Another way to think about rebuilding, we've all seen both of these examples in different arenas of our lives, is that you construct something new where the old one was. So it's going to be in the same place, but it's going to look different. It's going to feel different. There's going to be something different about it. It's going to accomplish or perform many of the same functions, but it may not look the same, right? When the first wave of refugees returning from Babylon got home, their focus was the former. They were trying to put back up exactly what came down. It's what compelled them to go home in the first place. They got news, they got word that their capital city had been destroyed, that their sacred temple had been destroyed, and they were heartbroken by it. They wanted to get home, and they wanted to put those things back up. So it's interesting that when they got back, and when they actually reconstructed the foundation for their temple, right, their sacred space, the story that narrates their journey, the book of Ezra, says that there was a mixed response. So in chapter 3, verse 11, they've laid the foundation for the new temple. It's been 70 years since their old temple was destroyed. They've come back home, some of them. They've reconstructed a foundation for a new building. And verse 11 says, "Then all the people gave a great shout, praising the Lord, because the foundation of the Lord's temple had been laid." And that makes sense. You would expect people on a day like that to look at this new foundation and praise God. Like, this is a great thing. Verse 12, however, says, "But many of the older priests, Levites, and other leaders who had seen the first temple wept aloud when they saw the new temple's foundation. The others, however, were shouting for joy." So you get a mixed response. Some people are shouting and praising. They think this is the greatest thing ever. But the story specifically says that the older people, the older priests, the older temple assistants, you know, the people who worked at the temple, probably the older lay people who remembered the temple, they worshiped there, they knew what that was like. When they see the new temple foundation, they're sad. They're weeping. And verse 13 says that the joyful shouting and weeping mingled together in a loud noise that could be heard far in the distance. I think that's great imagery. There was joyful praising and there was weeping, and it mingled together to make this loud noise. The question is, why the mixed response? Why are some people thrilled that we're home now, and look, we're putting back up what came down. We're getting back to normal. We're getting back to life as usual, and they're excited about that. When other people are looking at it and it makes them sad. Why the mixed response? Now, it's often argued, and you may have heard this, that the reason the older generation, the people who had seen the original temple, they'd worshiped there, they'd worked there, the reason that they weep is because when they look at the new temple foundation, it's just not as cool as the old one. It's not as big, it's not as extravagant, it's not as splendid. It's sort of a shabby replica of the original, and it reminds them of what they've lost. And you can appreciate that. That makes some sense. What I think you got to keep in mind, though, and some of you know this, you're familiar with the story. When they built the original temple, the specifications were exact. The thought was that the temple is the place where God's presence dwells among the people. It was thought to be a kind of shadow, a kind of replica of a sort of bigger spiritual reality. And so it wasn't just any building. They believed that they had received exact kind of dimensions and specifications from God through Moses. This is exactly what the building is supposed to look like. It wasn't a haphazard process. In 1 Kings chapter 6, the basic dimensions of the first temple, 90 by 30 by 45. Give or take. Yeah, as we translate ancient dimensions, right? 90 by 30 by 45. I find it hard to believe that if I'm driven, if I'm compelled to go home because I want to rebuild a temple that had been torn down, and I'm a priest, as Ezra was, I'm going to be highly concerned with all things kind of liturgical, cultic. They don't think cult when you hear that word, but like our practices, the way that we do things. I'd be very surprised if they would return and not care about the exact specifications of the original temple. If they'd get home and they'd just say, you know what, we don't really have the means or the energy to like rebuild it the way that it was, so we'll just put up whatever. And in fact, in chapter 6, verse 3 in the book of Ezra, there's evidence to suggest that they didn't, that they actually cared very much about what they were doing. It says the new foundation was laid exactly on the old one. It was laid on the original foundation. And although there are some translation issues with this sentence, it would appear, and a ton of biblical scholars argue this, that the language that you get in Ezra chapter 6 is supposed to suggest that the dimensions were either exactly the same or very comparable. So while it makes some sense that an older generation would look at the new foundation and boy, it's kind of a shabby replica of the original and that makes us sad and it makes us think about all the stuff that we lost, that's possible. There's some merit there. Is it also possible that the mixed response, specifically the sadness among the older generation, has nothing to do with the size or the splendor of the new temple? What if it has to do with what the new temple represents? What if the older priests and the older temple assistants and the older lay people who worshiped in the original temple, what if the reason they weep when they see the new foundation laid is they see in it a return to a failed system? The shouters and the praisers, the people that were really excited about the new temple foundation, to express their excitement, they borrow language from Psalm 136. Psalm 136 is it's a call and response psalm. All right, so the leader would say something like, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good." And the crowd would say, "His faithful love endures forever." Okay, let's try it. You guys can do it. Let's try it. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His faithful love endures forever. And then the leader would say, "Give thanks to the God of gods. His faithful love endures forever. Give thanks to the Lord of lords." Okay, 26 times in Psalm 136, the leader says something about the goodness of God, and 26 times the crowd responds. So on the day the new temple foundation was laid, it makes sense that the leaders would appeal to the language of Psalm 136. And they would say to the people, "God is so good." And all the people would say, "Faithful love endures forever." But that isn't what they say, is it? Do you notice the difference? It's subtle. You gotta pay attention. God is so good, and they respond, "His faithful love for Israel endures forever." That may seem like a small difference. It's not. It's a huge difference. Psalm 136 is supposed to be a spiritual hymn. What they sing the day the new temple foundation was laid is more of a national anthem. You see, the temple wasn't just a religious building. It had become a political building. It was connected to a larger structure and religious apparatus. It was connected to a monarchy, a way of doing life together. For some people, when they got back home, when they saw that new temple foundation laid, this wasn't just about reconnecting with God. It wasn't about, you know what, we've been away and now we're back and we've got this new opportunity, this unique opportunity to reconnect with God, to evaluate our own faithfulness. Maybe to try things we haven't tried or to drop things we should have dropped a long time ago. This is a chance for us to be faithful to God the way God has been faithful to us. It wasn't just that. For a lot of people, this was a return to a political vision of what the people of Israel were supposed to be in the world. It was an opportunity to reemerge as a power player on the world stage. They were God's special people. God lived with them. They were the center of the universe. And this was a chance to get back to that. And they're excited about it. But not the older folks. I think the older folks know better, as they often do, right, older folks? The older folks know better because they'd lived through it. They knew that Israel's monarchy was not something to be proud of. It was something to mourn. The only reason that the people of Israel ever had a monarchy in the first place was because they looked around at all of the other nations around them and they said, We kind of want to do business the way they do business. They've all got kings, and they've got big armies, and they've got impressive cities with fortified walls, and they can defend themselves, and they can impose their will. We want to play ball like that. And all of the older people who heard the stories and they lived through it, they knew through experience what God tried to tell them from the very beginning, which was, I don't do business that way. That's not what we're here to do. And if you insist on doing business that way, it is going to go badly for you, and it did. I think the older folks, they hear it. They hear it in the national anthem. They see it in the new temple foundation. They feel it in the air. That this is a return to a system that never should have been, and it didn't work. Now, you're not going to tell the crowd that because they're not going to listen. But if I were there, I would weep too, I think. Because I would hear in the anthem the same distorted image of God that's been around for a long time. I would see in the temple foundation the same return to a failed system. And of course, I would know. I would know what God already told us. Which is round two is going to end up the same way round one did. If nothing changes. See, they, from the very beginning, right? They were supposed to be a people for people. They weren't chosen for themselves. They were chosen to be conduits of God's mercy and faithfulness for everybody else. But the day the new temple foundation is laid, what do they sing about? The only thing they can seem to think about or sing about is God's enduring faithfulness for them. And that's not unimportant. You and I would not be here. I don't think, maybe. Let me rephrase. I would not be here. I would not be here if it were not for having experienced in my life the enduring faithfulness of God for me. That's what changed my life. God's enduring faithfulness for me. I wouldn't be here otherwise. And I think for many of you, you wouldn't be here otherwise. You wouldn't be here in person. You wouldn't be attending online. You'd find something better to do with your Sunday morning and with your life. At some point, you experienced God's unfailing love for you, and it changed your life. It redirected your life, or it was supposed to. That's how this whole thing is supposed to start. So it's not an unimportant thing that they sing about God's enduring love and faithfulness for them. I'm not trying to dismiss that. But from the day you learned of God's enduring faithfulness for you, life was supposed to become about God's enduring love and faithfulness for them through you. Like the people of Israel, the church is supposed to be, we are supposed to be, as an apparatus, as an organization, and as every individual member in it. We are supposed to be conduits of God's mercy to the world. A reflection of God's enduring faithfulness for all people. That was their original call. But thousands of years down the road, as they have an opportunity to rebuild a life that was taken from them, there's a ton of evidence to suggest that they were just trying to rebuild something that didn't work. It wasn't working. They had not actually become people who were conduits of God's mercy for the world. That they were not thinking of themselves as a people with a purpose. And I think part of that is its structure, right? Its form follows function. It's what we build and how we do things has to be connected to why we're doing them. And if those things aren't coordinated, then oftentimes the what we do is serving a different why, and you get cross purposes, and I don't know which comes first, but they reinforce one another in a way that doesn't move you toward whatever the original goal was. That's what I see happening in Ezra in the rebuilding of the temple. They were supposed to be God's people with a mission to the world, and that message just had not gotten through. And I have to believe that at least part of that has to do with the way that they shaped their life. They went and got a king, and then they built a big city, and then they built a temple, and they did stuff. And all the stuff that they did was either going to reinforce this identity and vocation that we are people who have been loved, and therefore we are people who are going to go out into the world and we're going to love people in the name of the God who's loved us, or all those structures and practices reinforce something else, some other way of thinking about who we are and what it means to be God followers. Now just make a transition to the church. Like the people of Israel, the church, the Christian church, is a means to an end. It's a means to an end. It is not an end in and of itself. We are a people with a purpose. We're people for people. We've been invited into a relationship with the Almighty Father, creator of heaven and earth, made known to us through the person of Jesus Christ. We've experienced the enduring faithfulness of God in our lives, and that changed our lives, it redirected our lives, and from that day forward, all of life was supposed to be about participating in God's plan to reconcile the world to God's self. And we're supposed to be people who are out into the world helping people to be reconciled to God, to know the love of God in their lives the way we know the love of God in our lives, and to find ways to take risk, to sacrifice, to get creative, to be innovative, to do whatever we got to do through word and deed to communicate to other people who God is and what life with God is like. So, the challenging question as we find ourselves in this season of kind of unprecedented disruption and upheaval, is it working? Is our form and structure, the way that we do things, the way that we do church, the way that we do faith, is it working? I mean, to borrow language from our actual mission statement, to produce people who love God and love people. The challenging question is our way of doing church, is it actually accomplishing that mission? You got to ask the question on a couple different levels, right? Our mission statement is something that the church ought to be doing in the lives of the people who call themselves members of the church. So at an organizational level, I have to ask, and leaders in our church, we have to ask, we have to look around, and we have to ask the question. Our mission is to produce people who love God and love people. Is the way we're doing things as an organization, is it working? Is it accomplishing that? As we look around, do we see and hear and witness people actually producing people who love God and love people? And it's hard to know. Church is notoriously difficult to measure success in. It's why churches for so long, the way they measured success was butts in seats and dollars in bank accounts, because it's at least material. Doesn't mean anything good is actually happening. It's just, well, we can measure that. The truth of the matter is you measure success by story. You measure success by story. If the church is doing its job, if our forms and our structures, if our way of doing faith and church together is working, then you ought to have stories in your life. You ought to be able to bear witness and testify to the fact that you're doing things today You're thinking things today, feeling things today. You have perspectives today that you didn't have a year ago, or 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, or 5 years ago. That your time here, that your involvement here has changed you in some way. And I don't necessarily mean that you're out now doing extravagant things that you weren't previously doing. Every great writer of the Christian tradition would tell you that faithfulness is measured in the million mundane acts of everyday life. All right, it's saying you're sorry when a year ago you wouldn't have. It's choosing to sacrifice and to serve someone when a year ago you would have been selfish and done your own thing. It's not reacting with an unkind word when a year ago you would have. It's maybe you recognize you're a little more patient than you used to be. Maybe you're not so money obsessed as you used to be. Maybe you're not as afraid as you used to be. Maybe you're just kinder. Maybe you're not in such a hurry anymore and you can take your time. Maybe you're not so quick to react. Maybe they're not as wrong as you thought they were. Maybe you're a little more willing to listen and to learn. We have to ask questions at an organizational level. And this season's giving us the opportunity to do that. Is the way that we're doing church, what we're teaching, how we're teaching, what programs we offer, how we structure Sunday morning, all of it, is it working? And that's not it can't be a sort of rhetorical question. We need to know. Like, I need to hear from you. We need to hear from you. We need to know, hey, is what we're doing working? If it is, how? How has life changed for you? What's different now than a year ago or 2 or 5 years ago? And if it's not, that's okay. We just need to know how not. Because what we're committed to is the mission, producing people who love God and love people. Forms and structures and practices can change. The mission's what's important. If you called me on the phone or you sent me an email and you said, Mike, I just really don't feel like I'm being encouraged or equipped to live faithfully in my life, I would say, okay, fine. Tell me. Tell me what we need to change so we can do that better. Because we need to change it. We can't just uncritically go back to the way church was and hope that it's going to work. This is not a strategy. We need to know. So I just want you to know, I'm asking those questions. I'm asking all of the leaders in our church to ask those questions. I don't know the answers yet, but we're asking them. Because we need to ask them. Because we can't just go home and put back up that which came down and assume that it's going to keep getting the job done if it was never getting the job done in the first place. But we don't just ask the question at an organizational level. We have to ask the question individually. I'm not just the leader of this church. I'm a member of it. I'm a brother. I'm a follower of Jesus in my own life. And so I have to ask questions of myself. Is my approach to faith, is my approach to church working? I know that there are 10,000 variables in your lives that influence your faith and how it grows, and the church can't control many of them. It isn't just about what we do structurally as a church. It's also about how you and I approach faith and church in the first place. So I have to ask serious questions about myself. And this gets really challenging because I have to evaluate, you know what? If I'm at home and I'm short with my wife and my kids, and I'm impatient, and I'm rude, and I find myself thinking bad thoughts about other people who I see on television, or I'm typing snippy things in social media, okay, I need to start asking some really serious, challenging questions about myself. Because if the idea here is that I'm supposed to become someone who's reconciling the world to God, that's why I'm here. That's my identity. It is my vocation. It does not matter what I do to earn a living. I could be a pastor or a banker or a teacher or a garbage collector. It doesn't matter. For people of God, the vocation is the same. We are people who have been loved by God, and our identity and our mission is to be conduits of God's love in the world, to reconcile people to God. And if I'm looking around at my life and I'm realizing that I'm just not doing that very well, one of the questions I have to ask is, well, what's my approach to faith in church right now? How do I see my role in it? What am I giving? What am I expecting? What are my sort of perspectives and views on this whole thing? Those are the challenging questions we got to ask. I have no idea. I have no idea where life's going. Nobody knows. I don't know when this season's going to be over or if this season's going to be over. I don't know that we're going to wake up one day and there's going to be some hard distinction between, oh, wasn't that strange COVID season? Oh, thank God that's over. I don't even know if we're going to have a hard distinction like that. I don't know what life's going to look like moving forward. I don't know what church is going to look like moving forward. What I know is that we are supposed to be a certain kind of people. We're supposed to be people for people, people with a purpose. And all of that begins with our own experience of God's enduring love and faithfulness. And maybe that's where you have to begin. Maybe you have to begin by reconnecting with where this whole thing is supposed to begin. God meeting you in your deep and profound need. God meeting me, right, as someone whose life was falling apart. And I was so in desperate need of forgiveness. And I found it in God. That's where things have to begin. Maybe you need to go back and you need to rekindle, reconnect with where you began, where God met you when you needed God. And let that little spark get fanned into a flame so that your life becomes not about you, but about God's love for you, through you, for the people in your world. Not just your family members or your friends or the people you like, but everybody. I don't want to lead a church where we have some, you know, kind of mixed response to what we're doing. I want to have a unified voice. I want to have this unified voice where everybody's saying, his faithful love endures forever, period. Hard stop. We know that because of how God has loved us, and now we're going to tell you that. We're going to show that to you so that you can join us. And that chorus only gets louder as we sing it together. We need to rebuild for mission, whatever that looks like, organizationally and personally. And that's where we're going. That's what we're going to do. We're going to finish our service this morning by taking communion.
If you had questions during the message, text them to 567-246-0807, and we will address them during our next Facebook Live Q&A. For additional content, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our website, watervillecc.org. You can also watch our live stream service on YouTube every Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern, or replay at any time. Thanks for listening.